Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for January 4th, 2011. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and today I'll be speaking with our Chief Scientific Editor about the past year of research in science signaling. This week's issue features our yearly editorial guide that highlights the biggest breakthroughs in cell signaling research published during the past year. In this first podcast of the year, we'd like to focus specifically on research that was published in Science Signaling. Today, I'll be taking a look back at the previous year's most notable research with Chief Scientific Editor Michael Yaffe, and we'll look ahead to what to expect in 2011.
There were a lot of very interesting and impressive papers that we published this year in Science Signaling. Some of the ones that I found particularly intriguing included a paper from Jerry Hart's lab that looked at crosstalk between glucuronacylation and phosphorylation and its potential involvement during mitosis. As I suspect many of our readers are aware, serine and threonine residues can be targeted by single sugar molecules as well as by phosphate groups, and there's been a fair amount of speculation about whether or not these two post-translational modifications might be competing for each other. A good deal of work on this has really been done by Jerry Hart's lab at Hopkins, and it's been rather difficult for technical reasons to be able to answer that question. In this paper, Jerry teamed up with Don Hunt's lab and used a very clever labeling approach in order to be able to identify by mass spectrometry those proteins that were modified by O-glucuronacylation. And surprisingly, a large number of those turned out to be proteins that were involved in processes related to cell division. One of the most interesting aspects that emerged from that work was the finding that O-glucuronacylation occurred with a stoichiometry that would rival phosphorylation at spindles and midbodies in dividing cells, as well as the finding that O-glucuronacylation seemed to inhibit the activation of cyclin-dependent kinase 1. In addition, a large number of proteins that were involved in things like RNA processing and transcriptional control also appeared to be targets for O-glucuronacylation, and I suspect that this crosstalk is something that we'll be hearing more about in the years to come. A second paper that I found particularly intriguing was a paper that came out from Eileen White and Bob Abraham's labs and identified ammonia as a molecule that seemed to be involved as an inducer of autophagy. In that paper, they showed that when conditioned media from starved cells was applied to other cells in culture, it was capable of inducing autophagy in those cells. And the inducing agent turned out to be ammonia that was derived from glutaminolysis in the starved cells. And I thought that this was an important paper because it suggested that glutamine metabolism, which is not only important for culturing almost all of the typical cells that we grow in culture, but in particular, it suggested that the products of glutamine metabolism might act in an autocrine or paracrine manner in order to control the metabolism of adjacent cells. And this idea of paracrine metabolism, I think, is something that's likely to also emerge over the next few years as an increasingly recognized mechanism for cell-cell communication. There were a number of papers as well that discussed novel roles for specific metabolites, particularly arginine, in immune responses.
What about papers that use some groundbreaking or innovative techniques or creative approaches that are likely to be adopted by other labs in the future?
There were two papers that stood out for me as being particularly innovative, not necessarily because they had pioneered a groundbreaking technique, but because they had integrated a variety of techniques in order to discover some fascinating new biology. One of those papers was a paper by David Sherwood's lab where they used C. elegans as a model system in order to identify through RNAi screening 99 genes that seem to be particularly important in regulating cell invasion across basement membranes. I view that paper as particularly innovative because it used a variety of techniques to address a rather complicated cell biological process, something that's a bit more complex to monitor accurately than, say, cell proliferation or cell death. And in addition, they took the findings that they had made in worms and then identified the human orthologs of some of the critical genes and showed that downregulation of these orthologs reduced the invasiveness of metastatic carcinoma cells. And so I liked the fact that this paper not only used a wide variety of techniques, but made the jump from a model organism in which they could do RNAi combined with this more complex cell biological phenotype, and then brought this technique around to examine biology relevant to human disease.
And the second one?
The second paper that I found particularly intriguing in this regard was a paper from Mike Fanzilber's lab that used a combination of phosphoproteomics and gene expression profiling to examine retrograde injury signaling in rat sciatic nerve axons in vivo. And what I liked best about this paper was the fact that it used not only a variety of techniques, but examined an in vivo phenotype, in this case, the response of neurons to a lesion ligation model. And by combining the phosphoproteomics with the transcriptional data, they were able to identify a variety of pathways, such as the ABLE pathway, the P38 pathway, and the PKC pathway, that all affected the response of these sensory neurons to injury. And so again, I think this was an example where multiple techniques were brought together to bear on a more complex biological phenotype, in this case neuronal injury, than I have seen done previously.
So what about the papers that surprised you? What paper published in Science Signaling in 2010 reported some results that were the most unexpected, or maybe something that overturned some previously held dogma?
There were two papers that really caught my eye in this regard. One was a paper from Martin Schmidt that was published in August that showed that US28, a cytomegalovirus-encoded G-protein-coupled receptor, seemed to signal through the STAT3 and IL-6 pathway in order to drive cell proliferation. I think this is a fascinating example of how pathogens opportunistically manipulate host pathways, and in this case, the authors were able to extend this work by showing that this fascinating pathway involving a viral protein activating an IL-6 axis was relevant to human glioblastoma cells in patients' tumors. In fact, they were able to show that elevated levels of phospho-STAT3 in human glioblastomas correlated with a poor prognosis. So I thought this was a particularly striking result, showing how viruses are able to manipulate host signaling pathways with relevance to human cancer. The second paper that I found particularly fascinating was a structural biology paper that described the crystal structure of the alpha kinase domain of dictyostelium myosin heavy chain kinase A. In this paper, the authors were able to find that this protein kinase, which bears no sequence similarity to any typical eukaryotic protein kinase, shows the typical kinase fold that we are all used to seeing. However, in this case, it appears that there may be a phosphoaspartyl intermediate that's involved in transferring the phosphate group from ATP to the substrate. As far as I'm aware, this would be the first demonstration of an aspartyl phosphate group playing such a predominant role in kinase signaling in eukaryotic cells.
What overall trends did you note in the papers that we published during this last year?
I think one of the things that came out very strongly was crosstalk between different signaling pathways. For example, Wei Su had an article that described crosstalk between the Wnt pathway and the FGF pathway in controlling mesenchymal stem cell fate during skeletal morphogenesis. Mark Williams had a paper that showed that DUOX1, a member of the NADPH oxidase family, produces hydrogen peroxide that turned out to be important for TCR signaling. And finally, there were a number of papers that showed how different PI3 kinase isoforms were important in B cell development in an analogous way to the emerging role of different PI3 kinase isoforms in T cell development. A second area that turned out to be remarkably interesting was the identification of metabolites as playing critical roles in signaling pathways. Wolfgang Junger had a paper that described purinergic signaling through an autocrine mechanism that was important for neutrophil activation, and Peter Hanley had a paper that described a similar role for autocrine purinergic signaling in regulating macrophage chemotaxis. A second example of small metabolite control was revealed in two papers that were published in the August issue of Science Signaling. Richard Lamb's group showed that arginine availability was critical for coupling TLR4 signaling to MAP kinases through activation of the upstream kinase tipple 2, while Peter Murray's lab showed that arginine availability regulates cytokine signaling in macrophages after infection by TB. In particular, increased arginase activity after TB infection, when present in uninfected macrophages, may provide an immunosuppressive niche within granulomas in which mycobacteria tuberculosis can survive. Another area that seems to be emerging in signaling is the use of combinatorial therapies or combinatorial approaches to enhance tumor cell killing. Lou Wiener and Erica Golemis had a paper in which they used an EGFR-centric RNAi screen to increase cell sensitivity to EGFR inhibitors in A431 cells. That is, by targeting specific components within the EGFR network, they were able to enhance the ability of EGFR inhibitors to limit cell proliferation. In a similar way, Bill Weiss's lab targeted AKT and autophagy and showed that by combining AKT inhibitors with inhibitors of autophagy, one could observe increased apoptosis of glioma cells. Two other trends that continue to emerge are the connection between signaling pathways and microRNAs. Per Pandolfi's lab was able to identify three microRNA families that appear to negatively regulate P10 in prostate cancer. And one of these three microRNA is present in the intron of a host gene, MCM7, with which it cooperates during prostate cancer development. A second important paper in this regard was a paper from Yossi Yarden's group, who showed that EGF decreases microRNAs that ordinarily downregulate oncogenic transcription factors. So both of these papers, I think, are bringing full circle how microRNAs work together with signaling pathways to control cell phenotype. Finally, in a paper that wasn't particularly microRNA related but connects signaling to the regulation of gene expression, was a paper that came out in March that described the mechanism underlying ischemic preconditioning of the brain as resulting from gene repression by polycomb group proteins. This is of considerable importance given its direct medical relevance to diseases such as stroke. Finally, of course, mass spectrometry approaches continue to gain traction as a vital method for identifying signaling events on a global scale. Matthias Mann's group, for example, published a quantitative phosphoproteomic analysis of mitotic phosphorylation and made the surprising discovery that quite a number of mitotically phosphorylated sites on proteins appear to have a stoichiometry that approaches 1.
No year-end review would be complete without making predictions for the coming year. So, Michael, what do you see as the biggest areas to watch in signaling in 2011?
The areas that I see as awaiting breakthroughs involve the innate immune system and pathogen-mediated modulation of host signaling pathways, as well as the convergence of signaling pathways on the post-transcriptional control of gene regulation, in particular things like splicing, mRNA stability, and protein translation. Finally, I think we're going to continue to see extensions of pathway crosstalk in areas such as development, immunology, and neurobiology. Two other areas which I think are ripe for breakthroughs include improved methods of modeling combined with large-scale data sets in order to glean novel insights into how information from multiple pathways becomes integrated together to control cell phenotypes, as well as a continued connection between microRNAs, cell signaling, and human health and disease.
That was Chief Scientific Editor Michael Yaffe reviewing the Year in Science Signaling 2010. And that concludes this Science Signaling podcast. If you have any questions or suggestions, please write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. This show is a production of Science Signaling and of AAAS, Advancing Science, Serving Society. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and on behalf of Science Signaling and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for listening.